I hear that. I hear thy welcome voice. That's so accurate. You were not searching after God. He was searching after you. All right, we are in Joshua again. Please, chapter 4, if you will. Okay, we have been covering, I can't believe it's taken 3 weeks to do this, but that's just the way the cookies have crumbled, and that's no big deal. Chapters 3 and 4 give us that account of the crossing of the Jordan, and I think that they really need to be taken together as a unit. And I know you're probably sick of hearing me say this. I hope you're not, really, but I can't emphasize enough what a sterling, amazing picture this is of the Christian life. It's just amazing. You hear the word first. Everything is done foundationally by that. And, of course, you'll recall by now, hopefully you know, that the first 13 verses of chapter 3 are a series of five statements, some made by Joshua, one made by the officers of Joshua, and a couple made by the Lord. And all of it becomes revelatory. Okay, let's just review those real quick. First four verses, particularly you'll see in verse 2, you have the officer's message to the people. They're going to, no doubt, relay a modus operandi of how they're going to get across the Jordan that had already been discussed to some degree. Then, secondly, you have Joshua's message to the people in verse 5. Then, thirdly, you have Joshua's message singly to the priests in verse 6. And then, fourthly, the message of the Lord now comes to Joshua in a very powerful way, verses 7 and 8. And then finally, the fifth message is Joshua speaks to the entire nation in verses 9 through 13. All right, then I metaphorically applied verses 14 through 17. It's a short section, very verbose section, actually kind of hard, I think, to follow what's going on there. But the essence of it is this, that the priests that were carrying the Ark of the Covenant, their instructions were to get their feet covered in the water, all right? And as soon as God saw that every man that was carrying that ark, that the water was covering his feet up to his ankles, then God would part the Jordan River. And that's precisely what happened. But you had to get your proverbial feet wet first, you see. And then you could have the walk of success that God wants you to have as a believer. Okay, so you have the word, you have the subsequent walk, and now I really don't like alliteration. I try not to do that, but it just kind of fits so beautifully, I can't help it. All right, chapter 4 is all about leaving behind a witness, all right, making a proclamation, first to your family and then to the entire world, and that's what we'll see today. All right, now what I want to do is just read the entire chapter first. Okay, because I think that's just the best way to do it right now. All right, so let's do that. I'll read it slow, like a narrative. You try to follow with me. I'm going to try not to make comments. That'll be hard to do, but I just want to read through the chapter. Verse 1, chapter 4. And it came to pass when all the people were clean passed over. That's where we get that expression from, right? I guess in the West or in the South, they say they just clean done it, right? Well, they get that from the Bible. A lot of things came from the Bible in our history, in our culture. It came to pass when all the people were clean passed over Jordan that the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, and command ye them, saying, take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones, and ye shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodging place where ye shall lodge this night. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe a man. And Joshua said unto them, Pass over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of Jordan, and take you up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them, that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. Verse 8. And the children of Israel did so as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of Jordan, as the Lord spake unto Joshua according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them unto the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the ark of the covenant stood, and they are there unto this day. For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of Jordan until every thing was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak unto the people, according to all that Moses commanded Joshua, and the people hasted and passed over. And it came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over, that the ark of the Lord passed over, and the priests in the presence of the people. And the children of Reuben, and the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the children of Israel, as Moses spake unto them. About 40,000 prepared for war passed over before the Lord unto battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day the Lord magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. And the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, Command the priests that bear the ark of the testimony that they come up out of Jordan. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, come ye up out of Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord were come up out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up unto the dry land, that the waters of Jordan returned unto their place, and flowed over all his banks as they did before. What an amazing account. This is, everybody knows about the Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea, but, you know, hardly anybody knows about this one, which I think is just every bit as miraculous. Now, I want to point out, first of all, that the Lord was in absolute, total, 100% control of every single one of these activities that took place at the Jordan that day. Absolute, total control. Okay, he told the priests when to enter the river, and he told them exactly when to leave and to get back to the other side. It was God that told the water exactly when to roll back and then to return. And God was just totally orchestrating the entire thing. So not only did the people obey the Lord, but the water obeyed him as well. And then everything worked out exactly as God intended it. So what we're reading is precise, absolutely precise. No hiccups, no mess-ups, just total precision. And it was a day that absolutely glorified God. And then at this point, equally as important almost, for the sake of the people and for further instruction, it also magnified Joshua. And you can see, we just finished reading that in verse 14. On that day, the Lord magnified Joshua in the sight of Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. Joshua was given the absolute respect that he had to have if he was going to command millions of people and be their, not only their their military leader, but their spiritual leader as well. Now you have two heaps of stones that are going to be set up, and you might miss them if you're not paying attention. All right, two heaps of stones are going to be set up as memorials of Israel's crossing this Jordan River. You're going to have 12 at Gilgal, okay? 12 at a place called Gilgal. And the account of that will be basically in the first 8 verses. And then it'll be mentioned again in the second half of the chapter as well. And then you had 12 stones in the midst of the river in verse 9. Okay, so you have them in the middle of the river and in the and in Gilgal as well. Now, that's interesting because some have suggested that there is a total contradiction here, where because you'll notice back in chapter 3 and verse 17, where the Israelites are reported to have already crossed the Jordan. You see that? The very last verse of chapter 3, it says, "And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan." So some unbeliever, some skeptic, some person that just has to make stupid comments, they say, well, based on verse 17, that can't be right. There has to be a contradiction somewhere because they're, you know, because you have them back in the water again in chapter 4. Which is absolutely a totally stupid thing. What you actually have is verses 4 and 5 are just making a report. It's looking back on the issue, and it's just making a simple report that there were 12 men, one from each of the tribes, that Joshua had commanded to go back, where the priests were still standing in the midst of the dry bed of the Jordan. And then once they were there, they were taking up these 12 stones and carrying them over to the west bank, where everybody's eventually going to let off. They're going to wind up on the west bank of the Jordan, and they're going to build this cairn, for lack of a better word, commemorating the event. And so what you have is verse 9 recording that Joshua had another set of stones that he did of his own initiative, and he's going to put them right in the smack in the middle of the river. Okay, so I hope we can understand these two different piles. The stones that were placed at Gilgal, they were carried over by 12 men that were previously selected. Okay, one from each tribe. That's I think the correct way to read verse 12 of chapter 3. One man from each tribe. And when each of those men reached the middle of the river, they all picked up a fairly large stone. I mean, they're not just picking up little pebbles, you know. They're picking up something, I don't know, it probably was, I don't think, any bigger than a bowling ball, but something of that height and probably of that mass and something perhaps similar even to the weight of that, okay? And then they would carry it. The 8 miles, 7 to 8 miles that it would take to get to Gilgal. You have your map that was handed out to you tonight? If you have your map, take a peek at it and look at the top of the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. Okay, and you can see there a place called Abel Shittim. All right, that's where all this began. That was their camp. It's in the brush there in Abel Shittim. All right, and then they cross over, and then they walk another 8 miles. It's 8 miles from Abel Shittim to the Jordan. Some say 10. I don't think it's that far. After I looked at several other maps, but and then it's going to be another 8 miles to Gilgal. All right, so they're doing quite a bit of walking. All right, and these guys are carrying. Can you imagine carrying a bowling ball 8 miles? Well, that's what they did, and they carried it all the way. Now, it may not have been that heavy. Most bowling balls, I think, are 16 pounds. It may not have been that heavy, the rock. Maybe it was 10 pounds, maybe, you know, maybe something less. But still, that's what the Bible says they did, and they definitely did it. So these piles, these two piles, the one at Gilgal is going to be a memorial, okay? Now, Gilgal, the thing about Gilgal is it's Jericho's closest neighbor. It's like when two towns connect. You know, you're driving out of Bremerton, all of a sudden you're into Silverdale. Or you're driving through Silverdale, and then all of a sudden you're into Poulsbo. Okay? Gilgal was that to Jericho. Only the transition would have been, I think, even quicker. About 2 miles from Jericho as the crow flies, and excluding the Transjordan, that was the first territory in that was claimed by Israel for their inheritance then as they enter the promised land, right? There's no war. There's no battle. They just go. They camp at Gilgal. Gilgal becomes their first possession in the promised land. Later years, Gilgal becomes an absolutely critically important area, a very important geographical place for the nation. Let me give you five. This is not trivia. This is important. All right. First of all, Israel is going to crown their very first king at Gilgal. It's appropriate. It was the first city that they had, and it's appropriate that they crown Saul as the first king of Israel in 1 Samuel 11. And it's at Gilgal, number two, where David is going to be officially welcomed back after Absalom's rebellion is subdued. David makes his way back to Gilgal, and he's received again as a vote of confidence as the king of Israel. Thirdly, Samuel considered Gilgal to be so critically geographically important that he actually included it on, even though it was just a little, basically a little, you know, hole in the ground, he put it on his ministry circuit. Samuel had a circuit. He was a circuit-riding preacher, and he handpicked certain towns. Not every town. He couldn't make it to every single town, but Gilgal was one of Samuel's towns of choice to stop at to preach, according to 1 Samuel 7:16. Then fourthly, Gilgal was where the first school of the prophets emerged, according to 2 Kings 2, and then it's mentioned again in 2 Kings chapter 4. All right. And of course, you know what I'm talking about, right? The school of the prophets that emerged in the days of Elijah, and more importantly, Elisha. Okay, school of the prophets. And then fifth thing about Gilgal, it became very, very important to Joshua because it became senior moments, man, terrible. Terrible. Anyway, I'll skip what I was going to say because I can't remember the name of the place, but Gilgal becomes Joshua's fundamental headquarters. It becomes his basic center of operation. Let me show you that. Joshua 9 and verse 6. It says, "And they went to Joshua under the camp at Gilgal." That's where he kept his headquarters. Okay. Notice chapter 10, verse 6. "And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp to Gilgal." See, that this is where he parks himself when he's not fighting. Notice verse 15, same chapter, chapter 10. "And Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, unto the camp to Gilgal." All right, then again you have it in verse 43. The Holy Spirit doesn't waste ink, friends. When he hammers something like this, It's important. It'll become important. 10:43, "Joshua returned and all Israel with him under the camp to Gilgal." Then you have it another time in chapter 14 and verse 6. "Then the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal." All right, so Gilgal becomes... who can help me? What's that town in Galilee where Jesus did all his, but he made his headquarters? Capernaum, thank you. That's what I was meant to say was Gilgal was to Joshua what Capernaum was to Jesus. All right. So let's get back to these heaps of stones. All right, these heaps of 12 stones, all right, it was a reminder of what God had done for these people. and it was to stay that way forever. The Jews were tremendous believers in teaching these things to the next generation, and that was taught to them by God himself, okay? And his anything that God had done and his special relationship to the people. In fact, this is prevalent all through Joshua. I won't take the time to record all, to rehearse with you all the verses. Begins, look at verse 6, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean ye by these stones? By the way, notice how the children ask the fathers, not the pastor, not the teacher, not the rabbi. They ask their father. The father is the spiritual leader of the house. That's the way it should be. You have it again. God mentions it again in verse 21. He spake unto the children of Israel, saying, when your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean these stones? Okay, so this is a something that just happens again and again and again. Exodus 12, 26. Exodus 13, 14. Deuteronomy 6, 20. God constantly rehearses this. From this day on, God's going to rehearse with these people to teach these things to your children. All right? Come, ye children, hear what God has done for you. It's actually part of Exodus. All right? Come see what I will teach you from youth. And then God would constantly say, you have this recurring refrain that this should be to all generations. God never wanted this train broken. The history of what God had done was so, so critically important. And by the way, it's important to us too. You know, you're feeling spiritually low. You're having issues with God or some other kind of thing. One of the best things you can do is think about all the things that God's done for you. I mean, that's such a help. Now, to your rank pagan, to these Canaanites, or to any other unbeliever, these heap of stones, just another pile of stones. No big deal, just a pile of stones. But to a believing Israelite, it was this constant reminder that Jehovah was their covenant God, and that he was able to do anything that required something powerful to be done. He could do it on their behalf. If they get discouraged, just look at those stones. And it was to trigger their memory of what God had done in the past. But then also notice how Joshua put an obligation on the Jews to fear the Lord and to bear witness of him to the whole world. You see that the very last verse of chapter 4. Why are we doing this? This seems crazy. These Canaanites are going to think we're nuts. Well, here's why we're doing it. That all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that ye might fear the Lord your God forever. Because the word would get around of what the stones meant. There must have been, I don't know that there was, but there must have been some kind of putty or cement-like substance that would have welded them together. So that they couldn't just crumble and fall apart, or you know, some kids couldn't run off with them too terribly easily. I strongly suspect that was the case. So you would have had like a pyramid type thing, or some kind of a mound that would have been very, very obvious. The God that can open the river that's the God that everybody ought to fear and that everybody ought to obey and love. And Israel needed to tell those other nations about him, right? And invite these people to trust him too, all right? The God of Israel. Here's what kind of God we have as opposed to your pagan gods. He actually, number one, he cares for his people. That's what those stones meant. Number two, he keeps his promises. If he says he's going to do something, he does them. If there's going to be a fight, there's going to be a battle, he goes before them in victory. And then fourthly, he can never fail. He does not fail. Just a tremendous witness to the world. Now, let me talk about how this actually went down, because I've been trying to figure it out myself. The best I can see is this. Remember, they had to keep a half a mile distance from the Ark of the Covenant. So the priests take the ark. They go right down to the bank. They're on the east side now of the Jordan. And they're going to put their feet in the water. Okay? The feet go in the water. As soon as God sees that every man's feet are in the water, he begins to part the Jordan. Meanwhile, the people left behind, the millions, the multitude left behind, they're going to wait for some kind of signal. There had to be some kind of signal, because as the Jordan is parting, the priests are moving out to the middle, okay, where they're going to stand. And then the people come, they eventually catch up, and they go across. It was a big, it wasn't just a little tiny opening. It's a big, wide, miles opening long. And they pass through while the priests are standing there with the ark. So the people walk right by him, probably a half a mile length away, all right, till they get to the other side and land on the west bank of the Jordan, okay? At that time, when the priests see that the last person has stepped over to the other side, now they, too, are going to follow behind the crowd, and they're going to be, so they're the first ones in, all right, and the last ones out, the priests are. And then as soon as the priest, when the last priest steps onto the west bank of the Jordan, here come the waters back in again, okay? But before that, Joshua, from the best I can tell, of his own initiative, all right, goes back and erects his own pile right in the middle of the Jordan River. And that's just because that's the kind of guy he was. and that pile was, no one would ever see it except that Joshua knew that it was there. It was important for him. And I think he would have constructed it exactly the same way, perhaps, that the pile would be erected in Gilgal. And so when the waters came back, it's not going to just dump water like it did at the Red Sea. It'll just slowly trickle until it reaches its full volume for that time of year. But obviously deep enough to where the Joshua's pile would have been submerged. Okay. Now, we know that the Gilgal pile stayed in place, because one of the sad things is that that pile slowly started to lose its spiritual meaning, and it becomes the shrine where the Jews are going to wind up sinning against God by worshiping there instead of in Jerusalem. It's going to become a big issue during the reign of Jeroboam, and it's just a sad thing. In fact, God sicked two prophets on these people to warn, especially the 10 tribes of the north. That would be Hosea and Amos. Both of those guys. Those are the only two prophets that preached to the 10 northern tribes. Every other prophet preached to Judah. Okay? So Hosea, I mean, he just lets it rip. Let me just read you some of these passages. Hosea 4 and verse 15. Hosea says, "Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend, and come not ye unto Gilgal, neither go ye up to Beth-Aven, nor swear the Lord liveth." Right? Don't stop coming to Gilgal. You know where you're supposed to be. All right? And Judah, God forbid that you should abandon Jerusalem. Don't you come up here either. Okay, Beth-Aven. That meant something. I lost it. Place of cursing, house of cursing. Yeah. All right, so Hosea 4:15 and Hosea 9:15. Here's this prophet scoring these people. "All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them for the wickedness of their doings." Wow, tough. Chapter 12, verse 11. "Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are vanity. They sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal." Yea, their altars are as heaps in the furrows of the fields. It's a play on what Hosea is doing there. He's actually playing on the original heap of stones. He said, instead of the original heap of stones and having them have maintained their original purpose as a memorial, you people are over here sacrificing in Jeroboam's new fake religion. You see. So, And Amos is just as strong about the abuse of what God intended to be a powerful thing to help them. But the thing is, friends, teaching the next generation, this is where the great failure is. Unless the next generation is taught the truth about God, it's absolutely guaranteed that they will go the way of the world. It's guaranteed. They may do that anyway. And if we don't teach, if the next generation is not taught, then it's just not going to be very good. By the way, the NIV only has one pile of stones. But we might get used to that. I mean, I don't want to make a big deal out of it, but they put the second pile in a footnote and claim that it's not part of the original text, which is absolutely insane. I think they know better than that. In fact, the footnote seems to indicate that they know better, but they did it anyway, because that's what rebels do. So Joshua sets this monument up right in the middle of the river, knowing that the water would go over it. That was just between him and God, him and his God. All right, and the Jews would know about it also because they watched him do it. Don't you think that would have been a strange thing for a leader to do? Think of the courage it would have taken to do that. Did Joshua know when the water would come back? Think of all 12 of those guys. They would have had to have gone back over and get those stones, and Joshua joined them, okay? How did they know that the water wasn't going to just come back and overwhelm them? Well, they didn't. I don't know if they did or didn't. I suspect they didn't. And if they didn't, it took great faith to do that. They had to trust God. And God will do that to us. He'll put us in situations where we're forced to trust him. I mean, after all, who but God could see these 12 stones that are going to be heaped together in a riverbed at the bottom of a river? In fact, I don't have any reason to doubt that they're still there today. Why wouldn't they be? I mean, we're not told anywhere that God commanded Joshua to do this. This is what people do that are overflowing with God. They just do stuff, right? Now, maybe he did. I don't want to make too big a deal out of that, but at least he didn't. I mean, we have no record of God reproaching Joshua for setting up this second monument in the river. There's no rebuke for that. All right, at any rate, this monument at Gilgal, it reminded the Jews that God had parted the Jordan just like he had the Red Sea, and that he brought them safely across into the promised land. Okay? They'd made a break with the past, and they were not ever to think about going back again. Okay? In fact, the only ones that would wind up on the Trans-Jordan side would be Ephraim and Manasseh and the half-tribe of... there's a third one. They're listed here somewhere. Gad. Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. They would have their allotment eventually on the Transjordan side. By the way, you had 40,000, verse 13, 40,000 of their best warriors that helped lead. They actually led the procession to catch up to the priests and to cross. So it was these 40,000 warriors who are going to have their possession on the Transjordan side that actually lead the procession over into the west. Now, by the way, that wasn't all, because according to Numbers, they had 140,000 warriors. So only 29% came and actually crossed the Jordan to lead that expedition, probably because the others had families, children, wives that needed to be protected from Canaanites. So that's what I suspect, okay? So the monument at Gilgal reminded the Jews of how God had got them through and over that river. And the monument in the river that Joshua made reminded them of their old life, how that was buried, and that now they're to walk in newness of life. I'm sure that that's what it meant to Joshua. If we could interview Joshua tonight and say, what was going on with this thing? I think he would have quoted Romans 6, 1 through 4. That's what I think he would have done. In fact, when we get to chapter 5, I'm going to really hammer the spiritual significance for us today of establishing of this monument and of our own monuments, to be able to have some things in our own life where we were able to remind ourselves of what God has done for us. Meanwhile, whenever these Jewish kids, they ask Dad, what's the meaning of these stones, right? All right, it's Dad's job. Or, I mean, if Dad's not around, they're asking Mom, she can answer too. And they're to tell the whole story about the miracle that they experienced with God, all right? And then they might add, but there's another monument in the middle of the river where the priest stood with the ark, right? You can't see it, but it's there. And that reminds us that our old life has been buried and we have to live a new life that is now walking in the Spirit, a life of obedience and faith to God. And the children would have had to have accepted that by that fact by faith, which evidently very few of them ever did. All right. Now they did. I mean, they were told about it. They were able to see the monument above the ground, but all right, they never. It didn't make much of a difference for them, evidently. So these stone monuments. These were the first of several stone monuments that the Jews are going to put up in Israel. In fact, in obedience to Moses' previous instructions, they set up stones, it's called stones of blessing and stones of cursing, at Mount Ebal and then again at Mount Gerizim. Moses constructed them to set up stones there. They also raised a heap of stones over Achan, right, and Achan's household. In chapter 7. And at the close of his life, Joshua set up a witness stone at Shechem in chapter 24. Okay. So those 2.5 tribes that lived east of the Jordan, they set up a great altar, it says, to remind their children that they were a part of the nation Israel, even though the river separated them from the other tribes. And the Holy Spirit makes a big deal out of that in chapter 22. When we get there, I'm not trying to get ahead of myself, but I think it's pertinent. Now, there's nothing wrong with memorials, provided they don't become religious idols, you know, idols that turn our hearts away from God, and provided they don't link us to so heavily in the past that we fail to serve God in the present. You know, that's an ever-present danger. The next generation, they need reminders of what God has done in history. But those reminders are intended to strengthen these people's faith, to draw them closer to Christ. I love that phrase in Deuteronomy 6:23. God brought them out that he might bring them in. And it's the same thing with us. God took us out of the world to bring us into his fold and to function in a way that's pleasing to him. He brings us in that we might overcome and claim our spiritual inheritance in the Lord Jesus. We're identified with him in his death, his burial, his resurrection. We have overcoming power. We've overcome the world, the flesh, and the devil. And we don't ever need to be defeated by any of those things. Just like Israel could have won every single battle they ever fought if they trusted him. Because They could have been just like we are today. We're overcomers in Christ. And faith is the victory that overcomes the world. And it all started when they got their feet wet, those priests. If they didn't do that, there would have been no parting of the sea. And we have to get our feet wet too. And then we need to follow God. All right.